The priests stood around me and saw me not. They stood around a stone tomb resting in the center of the chamber. The chanting increased, and the ringing of the silver bells too. At last, at a signal given by an old man, six monks stopped and panting and grunting lifted the stone lid off the coffin. Inside, as I looked down, I saw my own body, a body clad in the robes of a priest of the Lama class. The monks were chanting louder now, singing, "O spirit of the visiting Lama, wandering the face of the world above, return for this, the third day has come and is about to pass." A first stick of incense is lit to recall the spirit of the visiting Lama. A monk stood forth and lit a stick of sweet-smelling incense, red in color, and then took another from a box as the priest chanted, "O spirit of the visiting Lama, returning here to us, hasten for the hour of your awakening draws nigh." A second stick of incense is lit to hasten your return. As the monk solemnly drew a stick of incense from the box, the priest recited, "O spirit of the visiting Lama, we await to reanimate and nourish your earthly body. Speed you on your way, for the hour is at hand, and with your return here another grade in your education will have been passed." A third stick of incense is lit at the call of returning. As the smoke swirled lazily upwards engulfing my astral form, I shivered in dread. It was as if invisible hands were drawing me, as if hands were drawing on my silver cord, drawing me down, reeling me in, forcing me into that cold, lifeless body. I felt the coldness of death, I felt shivering in my limbs, I felt my astral sight grow dim, and then great gasps racked my body which trembled uncontrollably. High priests bent down into the stone tomb, lifted my head and my shoulders, and forced something bitter between my tightly clenched jaws. I thought, back in the confining body again, back in the confining body. It seemed as if fire was coursing through my veins, veins which had been dormant for 3 days. Gradually the priest seized me out of the tomb, supporting me, lifting me, keeping me on my feet, walking me around in the stone chamber, kneeling before me, prostrating themselves at my feet, reciting their mantras, saying their prayers, and lighting their sticks of incense. They forced nourishment into me, washed me and dried me, and changed my robes. With consciousness returning into the body, for some strange reason my thoughts wandered back to the time 3 days before when a similar occurrence had taken place. Then I had been laid down in the self-same stone coffin. One by one the lamas had looked at me, then they had put the lid upon the stone coffin, and extinguished the sticks of incense. Solemnly they had departed up the stone corridor, bearing their lights with them, while I lay quite a little frightened in that stone tomb, frightened in spite of all my training, frightened in spite of knowing what was to happen. I had been long in the darkness, in the silence of death. Silence? No, for my perceptions had been trained, and were so acute that I could hear their breathing, sounds of life diminishing as they went away. I could hear the shuffling of their feet growing fainter and fainter, and then darkness, silence, and stillness, and nothingness. 41 Death itself could not be worse than this, I thought. Time crawled endlessly by as I lay there becoming colder and colder. All of a sudden the world exploded, as in a golden flame, and I left the confines of the body, I left the blackness of the stone tomb, and the underground chamber. I forced my way through the earth, the ice-bound earth, and into the cold pure air and away far above the towering Himalayas, far out over the land and oceans, far away to the ends of the earth with the speed of thought. I wandered alone, ethereal, ghost-like in the astral, seeking out the places and palaces of the earth, gaining education by watching others. Not even the most secret vaults were sealed to me, for I could wander as free as a thought to enter the council chambers of the world. The leaders of all lands passed before me in constant panorama, their thoughts naked to my probing eye. And now, I thought as dizzily I stumbled to my feet supported by lamas, now I have to report all that I saw, all that I experienced, and then perhaps soon I shall have another similar experience to undergo. After that I shall have to journey into the Western world, to endure the hardship forecast. With much training behind me, and much hardship too, I set out from Tibet to more training, and much more hardship. As I look back, before crossing the Himalayas, I saw the early rays of the sun, peeping over the mountain ranges, touching the golden roofs of the sacred buildings, and turning them into visions of breathtaking delight. The valley of Lhasa seemed still asleep, and even the prayer flags nodded drowsily at their masts. By the Pargo Kaling I could just discern a yak train, the traders, early risers like me, setting out for India, while I turned towards Chungking. Over the mountain ranges we went, taking the paths trodden by the traders bringing tea into Tibet, bricks of tea from China, tea which with Tsampa was one of the staple foods eaten by Tibetans. 1927 it was when we left Lhasa, and made our way to Chatang, a little town on the river Brahmaputra. On we went to Kanting, down into the lowlands through lush forests, through valleys steaming with dank vegetation. On we went suffering with our breathing, because we, all of us, were used to breathing air only at 5,000 feet or higher. The lowlands with their heavy atmosphere pressing upon us depressed our spirits, compressing our lungs, making us feel that we were drowning in air. On we went day after day, until after 1,000 miles or more we reached the outskirts of the Chinese city of Chungking. Encamped for the night, our last night together, for on the morrow my companions would set off on the return journey to our beloved Lhasa. Encamped together, we talked mournfully. It distressed me considerably that my comrades, my retainers, were already treating me as a person dead to the world, as a person condemned to live in the lowland cities. And so on the morrow I went to the University of Chungking, a university where almost all the professors, almost all the staff worked hard to ensure the success of the students, to help in any way possible, and only the very minute minority were difficult or uncooperative, or suffered from xenophobia. In Chungking I studied to be a surgeon and a physician. I studied also to be an air pilot, for my life was mapped out, foretold in minutest detail, and I knew, as proved to be the case, that later I would do much in the air and in medicine. But in Chungking there were still only the mutterings of war to come, and most of the people in this, an ancient and modern city combined, lived day by day enjoying their ordinary happiness, doing their ordinary tasks. This was my first visit in the physical to one of the major cities, my first visit, in fact, to any city outside Lhasa, although in the astral form I had visited most of the great cities of the world, as anyone can, if they will practice, for there is nothing difficult, nothing magical in the astral, it is as easy as walking, easier than riding a bicycle, because on a bicycle one has to balance. In the astral one has merely to use the abilities and faculties which our birthright gave us. 43 While I was still studying at the University of Chungking I was summoned back to Lhasa, because the 13th Dalai Lama was about to die. I arrived there, and took part in the ceremonies which followed his death, and then after attending to various business in Lhasa I again returned to Chungking. At a later interview with his supreme abbot, Taishu, I was persuaded to accept a commission in the Chinese Air Force, and to go to Shanghai, a place which, although I knew I had to visit, had no attraction whatever for me. So once again I was uprooted and made my way to another home. Here on July 7, 1937, the Japanese staged an incident at the Marco Polo Bridge. This was the actual starting point of the China-Japanese War, and it made things very difficult indeed for us. I had to leave my quite lucrative practice in Shanghai, and place myself at the disposal of the Shanghai Municipal Council for a time, but afterwards I devoted all my time to mercy flying for the Chinese forces. I and others flew to places where there was a great need of urgent surgery. We flew in old aircraft which were actually condemned for anything else but which were considered good enough for those who were not fighting but patching up bodies. I was captured by the Japanese, after being shot down, and they treated me quite roughly. I did not look like a Chinaman, they did not quite know what I looked like, and so because of my uniform, because of my rank, they were thoroughly unpleasant. I managed to escape and made my way back to the Chinese forces in the hope of continuing with my work. First I was sent to Chungking to have a change of scene before returning to active duty. Chungking was then a different place from the Chungking which I had known before. The buildings were new, or rather some of the old buildings, had new fronts, because the place had been bombed. The place was absolutely crowded, and all types of businesses from the major cities of China were now congregating in Chungking in the hopes of escaping the devastation of the war which was raging elsewhere. After recovering somewhat I was sent down to the coast under the command of General Yeo. I was appointed as medical officer in charge of the hospital, but the hospital was merely a collection of paddy fields which were thoroughly waterlogged. The Japanese soon came along and captured us and killed all those patients who were unable to rise and walk. I was taken off again and treated remarkably badly because the Japanese recognized me as one who had escaped before, and they really did not like people who escape. After some time I was sent to be prison medical zero officer in charge of a prison camp for women of all nationalities. There, due to my specialized training in herbs, I was able to make the best use of the natural resources of the camp to treat patients who otherwise would have been denied all medication. The Japanese thought that I was doing too much for the prisoners, and not letting them die enough, and so they sent me to a prison camp in Japan, a camp which they said was for terrorists. I was herded across the Sea of Japan in a leaky ship, and we were very badly treated indeed. I was badly tortured by them, and their continual torture gave me pneumonia. They did not want me to die, and so in their way they looked after me, and gave me treatment. When I was recovering, I did not let the Japanese know how well I was recovering. The earth shook. I thought it was an earthquake, and then I looked out of the window and found that the Japanese were running in terror, and all the sky turned red. It looked as if the sun was obscured, although I did not know it. This was the atom bombing of Hiroshima, the day of the first bomb on October 6, 1945. The Japanese had no time for me. They needed all their time to look after themselves, I thought, and so I managed to pick up a uniform, a cap, and a pair of heavy sandals. Then I tottered out into the open air through the narrow unguarded doorway, and managed to make my way down to the shore, where I found a fishing boat. Apparently the owner had fled in terror as the bomb dropped, for he was nowhere in sight. The boat idly rocked at its moorings. In the bottom there were a few pieces of stale fish already starting to give off the odor of decay. There was a discarded can nearby which had stale water in it, drinkable, but only just. I managed to hack away the flimsy rope holding the boat to the shore, and cast off. The wind filled out the ragged sail when I managed to hoist it hours later, and the boat headed out into the unknown. The effort was too much for me. I just toppled to the bottom in a dead faint. A long time after, how long I cannot say, I can only judge the passage of time by the state of decomposition of the fish, I awakened to the dimness of a dawn. The boat was racing on, the little waves breaking over the bows. I was too ill with pneumonia to bail, and so I just had to lie with my shoulders, and the bottom of my body in the salt water, in all the refuse which swilled about. Later in the day the sun came out with blinding power. I felt as if my brains were being boiled in my head, as if my eyes were being burned out. I felt as if my tongue was growing to be the size of my arm, dry, aching. My lips and my cheeks were cracked. The pain was too much for me. I felt that my lungs were bursting again, and I knew that once more pneumonia had attacked both lungs. The light of the day faded from me, and I sank back into the bilge water, unconscious. Time had no meaning. Time was just a series of red blurs, punctuated by darkness. Pain raged through me, and I hovered at the border between life and death. Suddenly there was a violent jolt, and the screech of pebbles beneath the keel. The mast swayed as if it would snap, and the tattered rag of a sail fluttered madly in the stiff breeze. I slid forward in the bottom of the boat, unconscious amid the stinking, swirling water. Gee, Hank, there's a gook in the bottom of the boat, sure looks like a stiff to me. The nasal voice roused me to a flicker of consciousness. I lay there, unable to move, unable to show that I was still alive. What's the matter with ya? Scared of a corpse? We want the boat, don't we? Give me a hand, and we toss him out. Heavy footsteps rocked the boat, and threatened to crush my head. 46 man, oh man, said the first voice, that poor guy, he sure took a beating from exposure. Meb he still breathes, Hank, what you think? Aw, stop belly atchin'. He's good as dead. Toss him out. We got no time to waste. Strong, harsh hands grabbed me by the feet and head. I was swung once, twice, and then let go, and I sailed over the side of the boat to fall with a bone-rattling crash onto a pebble and sand beach. Without a backward glance, the two men heaved and strained at the stranded boat. Grunting and cursing they labored, throwing aside small rocks and stones. At last the boat broke free, and with a grating scrunch floated slowly backwards into the water. In a panic, for some reason unknown to me, the two men scrambled frenziedly aboard, and went off in a series of clumsy tacks. The sun blazed on. Small creatures in the sand bit me, and I suffered the tortures of the damned. Gradually the day wore out, until at last the sun set, blood red and threatening. Water lapped at my feet, crept up to my knees. Higher. With stupendous effort I crawled a few feet, digging my elbows into the sand, wriggling, struggling. Then oblivion. Hours later, or it may have been days, I awakened to find the sunlight streaming in upon me. Shakily I turned my head and looked about. The surroundings were wholly unfamiliar. I was in a small one-roomed cottage, with sea sparkling and glistening in the distance. As I turned my head I saw an old Buddhist priest watching me. He smiled and came towards me, sitting on the floor by my side. Haltingly, and with some considerable difficulty, we conversed. Our languages were similar but not identical, and with much effort, substituting and repeating words, we discussed the position. For some time, the priest said, I have known that I would have a visitor of some eminence, one who had a great task in life. Although old, I have lingered on until my task was completed. The room was very poor, very clean, and the old priest was obviously on the verge of starvation. He was emaciated, and his hands shook with weakness and age. His faded, ancient robe was patterned with neat stitches, where he had repaired the ravages of age and accidents. We saw you thrown from the boat, he said. For long we thought you were dead, and we could not get to the beach to make sure because of marauding bandits. At nightfall two men of the village went out and brought you here to me. But that was 5 days ago. You have been very ill indeed. We know that you will live to journey afar and life will be hard. Hard. Why did everyone tell me so often that life would be hard? Did they think I liked it? Definitely it was hard, always had been, and I hated hardship as much as anyone. This is Najin, the priest continued. We are on the outskirts. As soon as you are able, you will have to leave for my own death is near. For 2 days I moved carefully around, trying to regain my strength, trying to pick up the threads of life again. I was weak, starved, and almost beyond caring whether I lived or died. A few old friends of the priest came to see me and suggested what I should do and how I should travel. On the third morning as I awakened, I saw the old priest lying stiff and cold beside me. During the darkness he had relinquished his hold upon life and had departed. With the help of an old friend of his, we dug a grave and buried him. I wrapped what little food was left in a cloth, and with a stout stick to help me, I departed. A mile or so, and I was exhausted. My legs shook, and my head seemed to spin, making my vision blurry. For a time I lay by the side of the coast road, keeping out of sight of passers-by, for I had been warned that this was a dangerous district indeed for strangers. Here, I was told, a man could lose his life if his expression did not please the armed thugs who roamed at large terrorizing the district. Eventually I resumed my journey, and made my way to Yungi. My informants had given me very clear instructions on how to cross the border into Russian territory. 48 My condition was bad, frequent rests were necessary, and on one such occasion I was sitting by the side of the road idly watching the heavy traffic. My eyes wandered from group to group until I was attracted to 5 Russian soldiers, heavily armed and with 3 huge mastiffs. For some reason, at the same time, one of the soldiers chanced to look at me. With a word to his companions he unleashed the 3 dogs which came towards me in a blow of speed, their snarling fangs slavering with fierce excitement. The soldiers started towards me, fingering their submachine guns. As the dogs came, I sent friendly thoughts to them. Animals had no fear or dislike of me. Suddenly they were upon me, tails wagging, licking, and slobbering over me and nearly killing me with friendship, for I was very weak. A sharp command, and the dogs cowered at the feet of the soldiers, now standing over me. Said the corporal in charge, you must be a good Russian and a native here, otherwise the dogs would have torn you to pieces. They are trained for just that. Watch a while and you will see. They walked away, dragging the reluctant dogs, who wanted to stay with me. A few minutes later the dogs leaped urgently to their feet and dashed off to the undergrowth at the side of the road. There were horrible screams suddenly choked off by frothy bubbling. A rustling behind me, and as I turned, a bloody hand, bitten off at the wrist, was dropped at my feet, while the dog stood there wagging his tail. Comrade, said the corporal, strolling over, you must be oil indeed for surge to do that. We are going to our base at Criscino. You are on the move. Do you want to ride that far with 5 dead bodies?
Yes, Comrade Corporal, I should be much obliged, I replied.
Leading the way, with the dogs walking beside me wagging their tails, he took me to a half-track vehicle with a trailer attached. From one corner of the trailer a thin stream of blood ran to splash messily on the ground. Casually glancing in at the bodies piled there, he looked more intently at the feeble struggle of a dying man. Pulling out his revolver he shot him in the head, then reholstered his gun and walked off to the half-track without a backward glance. I was given a seat on the back of the half-track. The soldiers were in a good mood, boasting that no foreigner ever crossed the border when they were on duty, telling me that their platoon held the Red Star Award for competency. I told them that I was making my way to Vladivostok to see the great city for the first time, and hoping I would have no difficulty with the language. Aw. Guffawed the corporal, we have a supply truck going there tomorrow, taking these dogs for a rest, because with too much human blood they get too savage, so that even we cannot handle them. You have a way with them. Look after them for us, and we will take you to Vladi tomorrow. You understand us, you will be understood everywhere in this district. This is not Moscow. So I, a confirmed hater of communism, spent that night as a guest of the soldiers of the Russian Frontier Patrol. Wine, women and song were offered me, but I pleaded age and ill health. With a good plain meal inside me, the best for a long, long time, I went to bed on the floor and slept with an untroubled conscience. In the morning we set out for Vladivostok, the corporal, one other rank, 3 dogs and me. And so, through the friendship of fierce animals, I got to Vladivostok without trouble, without walking, and with good food inside me. Chapter 3. The road was dusty and full of holes. As we drove along we passed gangs of women in the charge of an armed overseer, filling up the deepest of the holes with stones, and with anything at hand. As we passed, the soldiers with me yelled ribald remarks and made suggestive gestures. We passed through a populated district and on until we came to grim buildings which must have been a prison. The half-track swept on and into a cobbled courtyard. No one was in sight. The men looked about in consternation. Then, as the driver switched off the engine we became immediately aware of a tremendous clamor, the shouting of men and the fierce barking of dogs. We hurried towards the source of the sound, I with the soldiers. Passing through an open door set in a high stone wall we saw a strong fenced enclosure which seemed to contain about 50 huge mastiffs. Quickly a man on the edge of the crowd of soldiers outside the enclosure gabbled out his story. The dogs with human bloodlust upon them had got out of hand, and had killed and devoured 2 of their keepers. A sudden commotion, and as the crowd shifted and swayed, I saw a third man, clinging high upon the wire fence, lose his grip on the wire and fell among the dogs. There was a horrid scream, a really blood-chilling sound, and then nothing but a snarling mass of dogs. The corporal turned to me, "Hey, you can control dogs." Then, turning to a soldier beside him, asked the comrade captain to come this way, "Say we have a man here who can control dogs." As the soldier hurried off I nearly fainted with fright on the spot. Me, why always me for the difficulties and dangers? Then as I looked at the dogs I thought, why not? These animals are not so fierce as Tibetan mastiffs, and these soldiers smell of fear to the dogs, and so the dogs attack. 51 An arrogant-looking captain strode through the crowd, which parted respectfully before him. Stopping a few feet from me, he looked me up and down, and a disdainful sneer passed over his face. "Faw, corporal," he said haughtily, "what have we here? An ignorant native priest?" "Comrade captain," said the corporal, "this man was not attacked by our dogs. Serge bit off the hand of a frontier crosser, and gave it to him. Send him into the enclosure, comrade captain." The captain frowned, shuffled his feet in the dust, and industriously bit his nails. At last he looked up. "Yes, I will do it," he said. "Moscow said that I must not shoot any more dogs, but they did not tell me what to do when the dogs had the bloodlust. This man, if he is killed, well, it was an accident. If he should live, though very unlikely, we will reward him." He turned and paced about, then stood looking at the dogs gnawing at the bones of the 3 keepers whom they had killed and eaten. Turning to the corporal, he said, "See to it, corporal, and if he succeeds, you are a sergeant.
With that he hastened away. For a time the corporal stood wide-eyed. Me, a sergeant? Man, he said, turning to me. You tame the dogs and every man of the frontier patrol will be your friend. Get in, comrade corporal, I replied. I should like the other three dogs to go in with me. They know me, and they know these dogs. So it shall be, he answered. Come with me, and we will get them. We turned and went out to the trailer of the half-track. I fondled the three dogs, letting them lick me, letting them put their smell on me. Then, with the three dogs jostling and bounding around me, I went to the barred entrance of the enclosure. Armed guards stood by in case any dog escaped. Quickly the gate was opened a trifle, and I was roughly thrust inside. Dogs rushed at me from everywhere. The snapping jaws of my three discouraged most from coming too close to me, but one huge, ferocious beast, obviously the leader, sprang murderously at my throat. For that I was well prepared, and as I stepped aside I gave him a quick thrust in the throat, a judo, or karate as people now term it, thrust which killed him before he touched the ground. The body was covered with a seething, struggling mass of dogs, almost before I could jump out of the way. The snarling and snapping noises were hideous. For a few moments I waited, unarmed, defenseless, thinking only kind and friendly thoughts towards the dogs, telling them by thought that I was not afraid of them, that I was their master. Then they turned, and I had a moment of revulsion as I saw the bare skeleton of what had moments ago been the leader. The dogs turned towards me. I sat upon the ground, and willed them to do the same. They crouched before me in a half-circle, paws outstretched, grinning, tongues lolling lazily, and tails sweeping from side to side. I stood up, and called Serge to my side. Putting my hand on his head, I said loudly, "From now on, you, Serge, will be leader of all these dogs, and you will obey me, and will see that they obey me." From outside the enclosure came a spontaneous roar of applause. I had forgotten all about the soldiers. As I turned I saw that they were waving their hands in friendship. The captain, his face suffused with excitement, came close to the wire and yelled, "Bring out the bodies of the keepers or their skeletons." Grimly I walked to the first body, a shredded, bloody mass with the chest bones bare of flesh. I took it by an arm and pulled, but the arm came off at the shoulder. Then I pulled the man by the head, with his entrails dragging along behind. There was a gasp of horror, and I saw it, that Serge was walking beside me, carrying the man's arm. Laboriously I removed all three bodies, or what was left of them. Then, really exhausted with the strain, I stepped to the gate and was let out. The captain stood before me. "You stink," he said. "Get cleaned of the filth of those bodies. You shall remain here for a month looking after the dogs. After a month they return to their patrols and you can go. You shall have the pay of a corporal." He turned to the corporal and said, "As promised, you are now a sergeant, as from this moment." He turned and walked away, obviously quite delighted with the whole affair. The sergeant beamed upon me. "You are a magic maker. Never will I forget how you killed that dog. Never will I forget the sight of the captain hopping from foot to foot filming the whole affair. You have done a big thing for yourself. Last time we had a dog riot we lost 6 men and 40 dogs. Moscow came down heavy on the captain's neck. Told him what would happen, if he lost any more dogs he will treat you good. You mess in with us now, we don't ask questions. But come, you stink, as the captain said. Wash off all that filth." I always told Andre he ate too much and smelled bad. Now I have seen him in pieces I know I was right. I was so tired, so exhausted, that even such macabre humor as this did not shock me. A group of men, corporals in the mess hall, guffawed loudly and said something to the sergeant. He roared, and hastened over to me. "Haw! Haw! Comrade Priest," he bellowed, eyes streaming with mirth. "They say that you have so much of Andre's insight on your outside, that you should have all his possessions now he is dead. He has no relatives. We are going to call you Comrade Corporal Andre for as long as you are here. All that was his is now yours. And you won me many rubles when I bet on you in the enclosure. You are my friend." Sergeant Boris was quite a good fellow at heart. Uncouth, rude in manner, and without any pretense of education, he still showed much friendship to me for securing his promotion. I would have been a corporal all my life else, he said, and for the large number of rubles he had won on me. A number of men had been saying that I had not a chance in the dog enclosure. Boris had heard, and said, "My man is good. You should have seen him when we set the dogs on him. Didn't move. Sat like a statue. The dogs thought he was one of them. He will get that crowd straightened out. You'll see. Bet on it, Boris," cried one man. "Take you 3 months to pay," said Boris. As a direct outcome, he had won about 3.5 years' pay and was grateful. That night, after a very ample supper, for the border patrolmen lived well, I slept in a warm hut by the side of the dog enclosure. The mattress was well stuffed with dried esparto grass, and the men had obtained new blankets for me. I had every reason to be grateful for the training which gave me such an understanding of animals' nature. At first light I was dressed and went to see the dogs. I had been shown where their food was kept, and now I saw it that they had a very good feed indeed. They clustered around me, tails awag, and every so often one would rear up and put his paws on my shoulders. At one such time I happened to look around, and there was the captain, outside of the wire of course, looking on. "Priest," he said, "I merely came to see why the dogs were so quiet. Feeding time was a time of madness and fights, with the keeper standing outside and throwing food in, with the dogs tearing at each other to get their share. I will ask you no questions, priest. Give me your word to remain here for 4 to 5 weeks until the dogs all move out, and you can have the run of the place and go to the city when you want to." "Comrade captain," I replied, "I will gladly give you my word to remain here until all these dogs leave. Then I will be on my way." "Another matter, priest," said the captain. "At the next feeding time I will bring my sign camera and take a film, so that the superiors can see how we keep our dogs in order. Go to the quartermaster and draw a new corporal's uniform, and if you can find anyone to help you in the enclosure, get them to clean it thoroughly. If they are afraid, do it yourself." "I will do it myself, comrade captain," I replied, "then the dogs will not be upset." The captain nodded curtly, and marched off, obviously a very happy man that he could now show how he managed the bloodlusting dogs. For 3 days I did not move more than 100 yards from the dog enclosure. These men were trigger happy, and thought nothing of shooting into the bushes in case there should be spies hiding, as they put it. For 3 days I rested, regaining my strength, and mixing with the men, getting to know them, getting to know their habits. Andre had been much the same size as me, so his clothes fitted reasonably well. Everything of his had to be washed and washed again, though, because he had not been noted for cleanliness. Many times the captain approached me, trying to engage me in conversation, but while he seemed genuinely interested and friendly enough, I had to remember my role of a simple priest who merely understood the Buddhist scriptures and dogs. He would sneer at religion, saying that there was no afterlife, no God, nothing but Father Stalin. I would quote scriptures, never exceeding the knowledge that a poor village priest could be expected to have. At one such discussion, Boris was present, leaning up against the dog compound idly chewing a sliver of grass. "Sergeant," exclaimed the captain in exasperation, "the priest has never been out of his little village. Take him around, and show him the city. Take him on patrol to Yardam and to Razdalnoye. Show him life. He only knows about death, thinking that that is life." He spat on the ground, lit a contraband cigarette, and stalked away. "Yes, come on, priest. You have stayed with the dog so long you are beginning to look like them. Though I must admit that you have them well behaved now, and you did win for me a pile of money. I float on air with it, priest, and must spend it before I die." He led the way to a car, got in, and motioned for me to do the same. He started the engine, moved the gear lever, and let in the clutch. Off we went, bouncing on the rutted roads, roaring into the narrow streets of Vladivostok. Down by the harbor there were many ships, almost more ships than I had known existed in the world. "Open quote, look, priest," said Boris, "those ships have captured goods. Goods which were going to be lend-lease from the Americans to some other country. They think the Japanese captured them, but we ship the cargoes over the railway, the Trans-Siberian Railway, back to Moscow where the party bosses have what they think is first pick. We have first pick, because we have an arrangement with the docs. We turn a blind eye on their doings, while they turn a blind eye on ours. Have you ever had a watch, priest?
No,
I replied, I have owned very little in my life. I know the time by the position of the sun and the shadows. You must have a watch, priest.
Boris speeded up the car and shortly we drew alongside a freighter moored to the dockside. The ship was streaked with red rust and sparkling with dried salt spray. The journey round the Golden Horn had been a hard and rough one. Cranes were swinging their long jibs, unloading the produce from different parts of the world. Men were shouting, gesticulating, manipulating cargo nets, and pulling on hawsers. Boris jumped out, dragging me with him, and rushed madly up the gangplank, still with me in tow. We want watches, Captain, he bawled at the first man in uniform. Watches, for the arm. A man with a more ornate uniform than the others appeared and motioned us to his cabin. Watches, Captain, bawled Boris. One for him, and two for me. You want to come ashore, Captain? Good time ashore? Do what you like. Girls, get drunk, we not interfere. We want watches. The captain smiled, and poured drinks. Boris drank his noisily, and I passed mine to him. He no drink, Captain, he a priest turned dog watcher, good dog watcher too. Good fellow, said Boris. The captain went to a space beneath his bunk and drew out a box. Opening it, he displayed perhaps a dozen wrist watches. Almost quicker than the eye could see, Boris picked two gold ones, and without bothering to wind them, slipped one on each arm. Take a watch, priest, commanded Boris. I reached out and took a chromium one. This is a better one, priest, said the captain. This is a stainless steel, waterproof Omega, a far better watch. 57 Thank you, captain, I replied, if you have no objection, I will have the one of your choice. Now I know you are crazed, priest, said Boris, a steel watch when you can have gold. I laughed and replied, steel is good enough for me. You are a sergeant, but I am only a very temporary corporal. From the ship we went to the Trans-Siberian Railroad sidings. Work gangs were busily loading the trucks with the choicest goods from the ships. From here the trucks would leave for Moscow some 6,000 miles away. As we stood there, one train moved out. Two engines pulling a vast array of railroad cars, each engine with five wheels on each side. Giant things which were well kept and which were regarded almost as living creatures by the train crew. Boris drove along beside the tracks. Guards were everywhere, from pits in the ground armed men scanned the undersides of the passing trains, looking for stowaways. You seem to be very afraid of anyone illegally riding the trains, I said. This is a thing which I do not understand. What harm could it do to allow people to take a ride? Priest, sadly replied Boris, you have no knowledge of life, just as the captain said. Enemies of the party, saboteurs, and capitalist spies would try to steal into our cities. No honest Russian would want to travel unless so directed by his commissar. But are there many trying to take rides? What do you do with them when you see them? Do with them? Why, shoot them. Of course, not many stowaways just here, but tomorrow I am going to Yardom and I will take you. There you will see how we deal with such subversive elements. The train crews, when they catch one, tie his hands, slip a rope round his neck, and throw him off. Makes a mess of the track, though, and encourages the wolves. Boris slumped in the driving seat, his eyes scanning the packed railroad cars trundling along. As if electrified, he sat bolt upright, and jabbed the accelerator right down. The car leaped ahead and raced past the head of the train. Slamming on the brakes, Boris jumped out, grabbed his submachine gun, and hid by the side of the car. Slowly the train rumbled by. I caught a glimpse of someone riding between two railroad coaches, and then there was the stuttering stammer of the submachine gun. The body tumbled to the ground between the tracks. Got him, said Boris triumphantly, as he carefully cut another nick in the stock of his gun. That makes 53, priest, 53 enemies of the state accounted for. I turned away, sick at heart, and afraid to show it, for Boris would have shot me as easily as he had shot that man, if he had known that I was not the village priest. The train passed on, and Boris walked to the riddled, bleeding body. Turning it over with his foot, he looked at the face, and said, I recognize this as a railroad worker. He should not have been riding.
Perhaps I should blow off his face so there will be no difficult questions. So saying, he put the muzzle of the gun near the face of the dead man and pulled the trigger, leaving the now headless corpse. "I have never been on a train, Boris," I said. "Well," he replied, "tomorrow we will go to Yardım by goods train and you can look around. I have some good friends there I want to meet now that I am a sergeant." For long I had cherished the idea of stowing away aboard some ship and steaming off to America. I meant yon ship stowaways to Boris. "Boris," I said, "you spend all your time stopping people at the frontier and making sure there are no stowaways on the trains. Yet all these ships, anyone could walk aboard and stay." Boris leaned back and roared with laughter. "Priest," he guffawed, "you must be a simpleton. The water guards board the ships a mile from the shore, and they check all members of the crew. Then they seal all hatches and ventilators, and pour cyanide gas into the holds and other spaces, not forgetting the lifeboats. They get a good bag of stiffs from reactionaries who do not know about this." I felt very sick at the callous manner in which these men treated the whole affair as sport, and I hastily changed my mind about stowing aboard ship. Here I was in Vladivostok, but I had my allotted task in life, and as the prophecy had stated, I had to go first to America, then to England, and back to the North American continent. The problem was how to get out of this part of the world. I determined to find out as much as possible about the Trans-Siberian Railway, where the checks and searches ended, and what happened at the Moscow end. The next day I exercised and fed the dogs early, and with them well settled, I set out with Boris and three other guards. We traveled some 50 miles to an outpost where the three guards were to replace three others. All the way the men were chatting about how many escapees they had shot, and I picked up some useful information. I learned the point at which there were no more checks. I learned that, if one was careful, one could travel to the outskirts of Moscow without being caught. Money was going to be the problem, that I could see. I made money by standing duty for other men, by treating their ills and through the good offices of some of them, treating wealthy party members in the city itself. Like others, I arranged to visit ships, and took my share of the spoils of new train loads. All my bounty was turned into rubles. I was preparing to cross Russia. Nearly 5 weeks later the captain told me that the dogs were now going back to their patrol stations. A new commissar was coming, and I must leave before he arrived. "Where was I going?" he asked. Knowing my man by now, I replied, "I will remain in Vladivostok, comrade captain. I like it here." His face grew apprehensive. "You must leave, get right out of the district. Tomorrow." "But comrade captain, I have nowhere to go, and no money," I answered. "You shall be given rubles, food, clothing, and taken out of this district." "Comrade captain," I reiterated, "I have nowhere to go. I have worked hard here and I want to stay in Vladivostok." 60 The captain was adamant. "Tomorrow we send men to the very limit of our area, to the boundary of Voroshilov. You shall be taken there and left. I will give you a letter saying that you have helped us and you have gone there with our permission. Then the Voroshilov police will not arrest you." This was far better than I had hoped. I wanted to get to Voroshilov, because that was where I intended to board the train. I knew that, if I could get to the other side of that city, I should be fairly safe. The next day, with a number of other men, I climbed aboard a fast troop carrier and we roared up the road on the way to Voroshilov. This time I was wearing a good suit of clothes, and had a large rucksack stuffed with belongings. I also had a shoulder bag full of food. It gave me not a qualm to remember that the clothes I wore had been taken from a dead ship jumper. "Don't know where you are going, priest," said Boris, "but the captain has said that he trained those dogs, so you had to leave. You can sleep at the outpost tonight, and be on your way in the morning." That night I was unsettled. I was sick, and tired of roaming from place to place. Sick and tired of living with death nudging my elbow. It was utterly lonely living with these people who were so alien, so absolutely opposed to my peaceful way of living. In the morning, after a good breakfast, I said goodbye to Boris and the others, shouldered my load, and set off. mile after mile I covered, avoiding the main road, trying to circle Voroshilov. There was the roar of a speeding car behind me, the squeal of hastily applied brakes, and I found myself looking down the muzzle of a submachine gun. "Who are you? Where are you going?" snarled a scowling corporal. "I am on my way to Voroshilov," I replied. "I have a letter here from Comrade Captain Vasily." Snatching the letter from me, he tore it open, frowning in the concentration of reading. Then his face broke into a broad grin. "We have just come from Sergeant Boris," he said. "Get in. We will drive you to Voroshilov, and let you off where you say." This was a nuisance. I was trying to avoid the city. But I climbed into the patrol car and was speedily driven to Voroshilov. I alighted near the police headquarters, and as the car shot off into the garage, I walked smartly along, trying to cover as many miles as possible before nightfall. I planned to camp out near the railroad and observe what happened for a night and day before climbing aboard. Passenger trains were stopped and checked at Voroshilov, but the goods train stopped just outside, possibly so that the local people should not see how many stowaways were killed. I watched and watched, and decided that my only hope was to get on a train just as it was pulling out. On the night of the second day, a very desirable train stopped, a train which my experience told me had many lend-lease cargoes aboard. This was not one to be missed, I thought as I eased myself along the tracks, peering under, testing locked doors, opening those which were not locked. Every now and then a shot rang out, followed by the thud of a falling body. Dogs were not used here for fear that they would be killed by the wheels. I rolled in the dust, making myself as dirty as possible. The guards came by, peering at the train, shouting to each other, flashing powerful lamps. No one thought to look behind the train, and the train only engaged their attention. I, prone on the ground behind them, thought my dogs would be far more efficient than this. Dogs would soon have found me. The men, satisfied with their search, strolled off. I rolled sideways to the track and darted between the wheels of a railroad car. Quickly I climbed onto an axle and hitched a rope I had ready to a projecting lug. Fastening it to the other side, I drew myself up and tied myself to the bottom of the railroad car floor, in the only position which would escape scrutiny. This I had planned for a month. The train started with a jerk which nearly dislodged me, and as I anticipated, a jeep with a spotlight came racing alongside, with armed guards peering at the axle bars. I drew myself tighter to the floor, feeling as a naked man would before a convention of nuns. The jeep raced on, turned and came back and passed out of my sight and life. The train rumbled on. For 5 or 6 miles I held grimly to my painful position, then convinced that the danger was over, I slowly eased myself out from the rope and managed to balance on one of the covers of the axles. For a time I rested as best I could, getting feeling back into my cramped and aching limbs. Then slowly, cautiously, I edged myself along to the end of the railroad car and managed to grasp an iron bar. For perhaps half an hour I sat on the couplings, then drawing myself up on that swaying platform, I crept blindly around the end and onto the roof. It was quite dark now, except for the starlight. The moon had not yet risen, and I knew that I had to work fast to get inside a wagon before any prowling trainman saw me in the Siberian moonlight. On the roof I tied an end of the rope around me, passed the other end around the roof rail and slid cautiously down over the side, paying out the rope I held. Bumping and scraping along the rough edges, I soon managed to unlock the door with a key which I had obtained in Vladivostok for the purpose. One key fitted all the train locks. It proved to be fantastically difficult to slide the door open as I swung like a pendulum, but sight of the first rays of the bright moon gave me that extra impetus. The door slid open, and I crawled exhaustedly inside. Relinquishing the free end of the rope, I jerked and pulled until the whole length was in my hands. Shaking with utter exhaustion, I slid the door shut and dropped to the floor. 2 or 3 days later, one loses all count of time under such conditions, I felt the train slowing. Hurrying to the door, I opened it a crack and peered out. There was nothing to be seen except snow, so I rushed to the other side. Train guards were running along after a group of refugees. Obviously a big search was underway. Picking up my belongings, I dropped over the side and into the snow. Dodging and twisting between the wheels of the trucks, I managed to completely confuse my snow trail. While I was still at it, the train started to move, and I grabbed desperately at the nearest icy coupling. By great good fortune, I managed to get my arms around one, and I hung there, feet dangling, until a sudden jolt enabled me to get my legs up as well. Standing up, I found that I was at the end of a truck which was covered with a stiff, frozen tarpaulin. The knots were solid ice, the heavy canvas was like sheet iron. I stood upon the swaying, ice-covered couplings battling with the icy knots. I breathed upon them, hoping that they would soften, but my breath froze and made the ice thicker. I dragged the rope backwards and forwards against the metal of the truck side. Darkness was falling when the last frayed strand parted, and I was able, with immense effort, to prise up an edge of the canvas and crawl inside. Inside, as I fell to the floor, a man jumped at me, flailing a piece of sharp steel at my throat. Instinct and habit came to my rescue, and the man was soon nursing a broken arm and moaning. Two other men came at me, one with an iron bar and one with a broken jagged bottle. To one with my training, they presented no real problem, and they were soon disarmed. Here was the law of the jungle: the strongest man was king. Now that I had beaten them, they were my servants. The wagon was full of grain which we ate just as it was. For drink we collected snow or sucked ice which we broke from the tarpaulin. We could get no warmth, for there was nothing to burn, and the train crew would have seen the smoke. I could manage with the cold, but the man with the broken arm froze solid one night and we had to dump him over the side. Siberia is not all snow, parts of it are mountainous, like the Canadian Rockies, and other parts are as green as Ireland. Now, though, we were troubled with snow, for this was the worst season in which to be traveling. We found that the grain disturbed us badly, it caused us to swell up, and gave us severe dysentery, weakening us so much that we hardly cared whether we lived or died. At last the dysentery abated, and we suffered the sharp pangs of starvation. I lowered myself over the side with my rope, and scraped the grease from the axle boxes. We ate that, retching horribly in the process. 64 The train rumbled on. Around the end of Lake Baikal onto Omsk, here, as I knew, it would be shunted and reassembled, I should have to leave, before reaching the city, and jump aboard another train which had been remade. There is no point in detailing all the trials and tribulations of the change of trains, but I, in company with a Russian and a Chinaman, managed to board a fast freight train to Moscow. The train was in good condition. My carefully preserved key opened the wagon and we clambered inside, hidden by the darkness of a moonless night. The wagon was very full, and we had to force our way in. There was no glimmer of light and we had no idea of the contents. A pleasant surprise awaited us in the morning. We were starving, and I saw that one corner of the wagon was stacked with Red Cross parcels which had apparently not reached their destination, but had been liberated by the Russians. Now we lived well. Chocolate, canned foods, canned milk, everything. We even found in a parcel a little stove with a supply of solid, smokeless fuel. Investigating the bales, we found them to be full of clothing and articles which could have been looted from Shanghai stores. Cameras, binoculars, watches. We fitted ourselves out in good clothes, for ours were in a shocking state. Our greatest need was for water. We had to depend upon snow which we could scrape off ledges. 4 weeks and 6,000 miles after I left Vladivostok, the train was approaching Nuzhinsk, some 30 or 40 miles from Moscow. The three of us held a discussion and decided that as the train crews were becoming active, we heard them walking across our roofs, we would be wise to leave. Very carefully we inspected each other to make sure that there was nothing suspicious about us, then we picked a very good supply of food and treasures with which to barter. The Chinaman went first, and as we slid the door shut after him, I heard rifle fire. 3 or 4 hours later the Russian dropped off, followed by me after a half-hour interval. I plodded along in the dark, quite sure of my way, for the Russian, a native of Moscow who had been exiled in Siberia, had carefully coached us. By morning I had covered a good 20 miles, and my legs, so badly battered in prison camps, were troubling me greatly. In an eating place I showed my papers as a corporal in the frontier guards. These were Andrei's, I had been told that I could have all his belongings, and no one had thought of adding except his official papers and identity card. The waitress looked doubtful, and called a policeman who was standing outside. He came in and there was much discussion. No, I had no food ration card, I had inadvertently left it in Vladivostok. Food regulations were not enforced for the guards at Vladivostok. The policeman fiddled with my papers, and then said, "You will have to eat on the black market until you can get to the food bureau and obtain another card. They will have to get in touch with Vladivostok first." With that he turned and walked away. The waitress shrugged her shoulders. "Have what you like, comrade. It will cost you 5 times the official price." She brought me some sour, black bread and some awful-looking and worse-tasting paste. She misunderstood my signs for drink, and brought me some stuff which almost made me pass out on the spot. One sip of it, and I thought I had been poisoned. One sip was enough, but the waitress even charged me for water, while she slurped up the vile brew for which I had paid so much. As I left, the policeman was waiting. He fell into step as I walked along. "This is very irregular, comrade, walking with a pack on your back. I wonder if I should not take you to the station for interrogation. Have you a spare watch on you, comrade, to make me forget my duty?" Silently I fumbled in my pocket, and then I produced one of the watches I had taken from the train. The policeman took it, glanced at it, and said, "Moscow, straight ahead. Avoid the main thoroughfare, and you will be all right." Then he turned and walked away. I plodded along the side roads, keeping a good lookout for policemen who might demand watches. It seemed to me, from my own experience, that Russians had a simply dreadful craving for watches. Many of them could not tell the time, but the mere fact of having a watch seemed to satisfy them in some strange manner. An emaciated man tottering ahead of me suddenly swayed and fell onto his face in the gutter at the side of the road. Passers-by did not even glance at him, but went on their way. I made as if to go to him when an old man just behind me muttered, "Careful, comrade stranger, if you go to him the police will think you are looting. He is dead anyway. Starvation. It happens to hundreds here every day." Nodding my thanks, I walked straight on. "This is a terrible place," I thought, "with every man's hand against his fellows. It must be because they have no religion to guide them." That night I slept behind the crumbling wall of a derelict church. Slept with about 300 others for company. My rucksack was my pillow, and during the night I felt stealthy hands trying to unfasten the straps. A quick blow to the would-be thief's throat sent him gasping and reeling backwards, and I was not troubled again. In the morning I bought food on the government black market, for in Russia the government runs the black market, and then continued on my way. The Russian on the train had told me to pose as a tourist, and to hang a camera, taken from the train, around my neck. I had no film, and in those days hardly knew one side of the camera from the other. Soon I found myself in the better part of Moscow, the part that the ordinary tourist sees. For the ordinary tourist does not see behind the scenes, the misery, poverty and death which exists in the slum side streets. The Moscow River was before me, and I walked along its banks for a time, before turning up into Red Square. The Kremlin, and the tomb of Lenin impressed me not at all. I was used to the grandeur, and sparkling beauty of the Petala. Near an entrance to the Kremlin a small group of people waited, apathetic, slovenly, looking as if they had been driven there like cattle. With a swoosh 3 huge black cars rushed out, across the square, and disappeared into the obscurity of the streets. As people were looking dully in my direction, I half raised the camera. Suddenly I felt a terrific pain shoot through my head. For a moment I thought that a building had fallen on me. I fell to the ground, and the camera was smashed from my hands. Towering Soviet guards stood over me. One of them was methodically and unemotionally kicking me in the ribs, in order to make me rise to my feet. Half stunned as I was, it was difficult for me to rise, so 2 policemen reached down and roughly dragged me to my feet. They fired questions at me, but they spoke so rapidly, and in such a Moscow accent, that I understood not a word. At last, tired of asking questions and getting no reply, they marched me off along Red Square, a policeman on each side, and one behind me with a huge revolver poking painfully into my spine. We stopped at a dismal-looking building, and entered by a basement door. I was roughly pushed, shoved would be a better word, down some stone steps and into a small room. An officer was sitting at a table, with two armed guards standing by a wall of the room. The senior policeman in charge of me gabbled out a lengthy explanation to the officer, and placed my rucksack on the floor beside him. The officer wrote what was obviously a receipt for me, and for my belongings, and then the policeman turned and left. I was roughly pushed into another room, a very large one, and left standing before an immense desk, with an armed guard on each side of me. Some time later, three men came in, and seated themselves at the desk, and went through the contents of my rucksack. One rang for an attendant, and, when he entered, gave him my camera, giving him brusque instructions. The man turned, and went off, carefully carrying that inoffensive camera, as if it were a bomb about to explode. They kept on asking me questions which I could not understand. At last, they called an interpreter, then another, and another until they found one who could converse with me. I was stripped of my clothes and examined by a doctor. All the seams of my clothing were examined, and some of them were ripped open. At last my clothes were flung at me, less buttons, less belt and shoelaces. At a command the guards hustled me out of the room, carrying my clothes, and marched me along corridor after corridor. They made no sound. Felt slippers were on their feet, nor did they speak to each other or to me. As we marched silently along, a really blood-curdling scream rose and fell quavering on the still air. I involuntarily slowed down, but the guard behind me jumped at my shoulder with such force that I thought he had broken my neck. At last we stopped at a red door. A guard unlocked it, and I was pushed in to fall headlong down three stone steps. The cell was dark and very damp. It was about 6 feet by 12 feet, with a foul and stinking mattress on the floor. For a quite unknown time I stayed there in the darkness, becoming hungrier and hungrier, wondering why mankind had such a savage nature. After a very long interval, a hunk of sour black bread and a small jug of brackish water was passed in. The silent guard motioned for me to drink the water then. I took a gulp, and he snatched the jug from my lips, poured the water on the floor and went out. The door closed silently. There was no sound except occasional hideous screams which were quickly and violently suppressed. Time crawled on. I nibbled at the sour black bread. I was hungry and thought that I could have eaten anything, but this bread was terrible. It stank as if it had been dragged through a cesspool. A long time after, so long that I feared I was quite forgotten, armed guards came silently to my cell. Not a word was spoken. They gestured for me to go with them. Having no choice, I did so, and we tramped through endless corridors, giving me the impression that we were retracing our steps time after time, in order to build up a suspense. At last I was marched into a long room which had a brightly painted white wall at one end. Roughly the guards manacled my arms behind me, and turned me to face the white wall. For long moments nothing happened, then very powerful, utterly dazzling lights were switched on so as to reflect from the white wall. It felt as if my eyeballs were being scorched even with my eyes shut. The guards wore dark glasses. The light beat down in waves. The sensation was as if needles were being pushed into my eyes. A door softly opened and shut. The scrape of chairs and the rustle of papers. A low-voiced muttered conversation which I did not understand. Then, the blow of a rifle butt between my shoulders, and the questioning began. Why had I a camera which had no film in it? Why had I the papers of a frontier guard stationed at Vladivostok? How, why? When, hour after hour the same stupid questions. The light blazed on, giving me a splitting headache. A blow from a gun butt, if I refused to answer. The only respite was for a few moments every 2 hours, when the guards and questioners were replaced by fresh ones, for the guards too, because exhausted by the bright lights. After what seemed to be endless hours, but which in reality, could not have been more than 6, I collapsed on the floor. Guards quite unemotionally began pricking me with their sharpened bayonets. To struggle to my feet with my arms, fixed behind me was difficult, but I did it, again and again. When I became unconscious, buckets of cesspool water were thrown over me. Hour after hour the questioning went on. My legs began to swell. My ankles became thicker than my thighs as the body fluid strained down and made the flesh waterlogged. Always the same questions, always the same brutality. 60 hours of standing. 70 hours. The world was a red haze now. I was all but dead on my feet. No food, no rest, no respite. Just a drink of some sleep-preventing drug forced into my mouth. Questions. 72 hours, and I heard no more, saw no more. The questions, the lights, the pain, all faded, and there was blackness. An unspecified time elapsed, and I regained a pain-filled consciousness, flat on my back on the cold, wet floor of a reeking cell. It was agony to move, my flesh felt soggy, and my back felt as if the spine were made of broken glass. No sound there was to show that others were alive, no glimmer of light to mark night from day, nothing but an eternity of pain, hunger and thirst. At last there was a chink of light as a guard roughly shoved a plate of food onto the floor. A can of water slopped beside it. The door shut, and again I was alone with my thoughts in the darkness. Much later the guards came again, and I was dragged. I could not walk to the interrogation room. There I had to sit and write my life history. For 5 days the same thing happened. I was taken to a room, given a pencil stub and paper, and told to write everything about myself. For 3 weeks I remained in my cell, recovering slowly. Once again I was taken to a room, where I stood before 3 high officials. One glanced at the others, looked at a paper in his hands, and told me that certain influential people had testified that I had helped people in Vladivostok. One testified that I had helped his daughter escape from a Japanese prisoner of war camp. "You will be released," said the official, "and taken to Strzyż in Poland. We have a detachment of men going there. You will accompany them. Back to a cell, a better one this time." While my strength was built up enough to enable me to travel, at last I marched through the gate of the Lubyanka prison, Moscow, on my way to the west.